Our body, the mirrored answer to the great question. My grandfather was a man of habit. When he found something that worked for him, he stayed with it. That may explain how he and my grandmother stayed married for over 50 years. After she died and he was living with his brother, my relationship with my grandfather changed. We developed an easy friendship and deeper level of sharing that lasted for the rest of his life. Grandpa's favorite place to eat was at the local franchise of a fast food chain called Wendy's. When I would visit for my out-of-state job on holidays or special occasions, I would always set a full day aside to take Grandpa anywhere he wanted to go. It was our day together, and I would ask him again and again, "Grandpa, where would you like to spend the day today?" I always followed my question with a list of beautiful restaurants and cafes, all of which were close to his home in the city. While he would listen carefully and actually mulled over each one in his mind, his answer would always be the same, and I always knew what it would be: Wendy's. One day, when Grandpa was sitting across the table from me at our favorite Wendy's table, he suddenly leaned toward me and just slumped over onto the table. He was fully awake and fully conscious. His eyes were clear, he could speak perfectly, and for all intents and purposes, everything else seemed fine. He just couldn't sit upright in his chair. It was on that day that we discovered Grandpa had developed a condition in his 80s that is often found in women in their 30s. It was called myasthenia gravis, and it makes itself known when a person's body becomes unresponsive to his intentions to move his muscles, stand up straight, or even do something as simple as hold his head up. Medically, it's defined as an autoimmune condition that results when the substance that normally carries the instructions between a person's nerves and muscles is absorbed by a special chemical, one produced by the person's own body. So while my grandfather could think a thought that commanded his body to sit upright, for example, and his brain would send the signal of that thought to his body, the muscles would never receive it. The chemical would hijack the signal. In other words, my grandfather had developed a condition where his body worked against itself in a battleground for two conflicting kinds of chemistry, one that produced everything he needed for his body to function normally, and the other that prevented those functions from ever happening. Between my travels, I spent as much time as I could with my grandfather. I tried to help him deal with his experience while I learned about his condition. During our time together, I learned something very interesting about his life and the history of our country, something that I believe was directly related to his condition. Grandpa was a young man working in a grocery store during the Great Depression. And if you've ever talked to people who lived through that time, you're probably aware of the tremendous mark that the experience left upon their lives. Seemingly overnight, everything for them changed. The economy ground to a halt. Factories stopped, stores closed, food was scarce, and people could not provide for their families. And my grandfather was one of those people. While he had done everything that was humanly possible to bring food home for his new wife and the extended family that shared their home, and had done so relatively well, in his mind, he believed that he had failed. And in his heart, he felt guilty for that failure. He felt guilty that he had failed as a husband, as a son, as a son-in-law, and as a friend, before he died. I remember asking my grandfather about the depression and his experience. And I remember the sadness that filled his face as he broke down and cried, telling me the story. It was still so fresh in his mind, so present in his heart, and so much a part of his life, even after over 60 years. Well, in my mind, the connection was obvious. My grandfather was not describing a passing sense of inadequacy about his life at an earlier time when he told me about the depression. He was describing a tremendous sense of chronic and unresolved guilt that he felt in the present. He'd harbored it all of those years, and it had eventually become somatized as his physical experience. The connection was obvious because belief is a code, and our feelings of belief are the commands of that code to our bodies. His subconscious belief that he was helpless to provide for his family during the Great Depression became the literal expression of his body. Through his mind-body relationship, his body recognized his belief as an unconscious command and masterfully produce the chemistry to match that belief. Quite literally, his body became the helplessness that he felt in his belief. I didn't have to search far to discover why the condition seemed to make its appearance so suddenly and at such a late stage in his life. Not long before the onset of his condition, Grandpa's wife, my grandmother, had been hospitalized for a cancerous condition that quickly took her life. Being hospitalized himself during her illness, in the same hospital no less, once again, my grandfather felt that he was helpless to do anything for the woman that he'd loved for 50 years. To me, the correlation between the circumstances of my grandmother's death and the sudden occurrence of my grandfather's condition was too great to be a coincidence. It was the trigger that brought all of the old memories of inadequacy from the Great Depression right into the present moment. Unfortunately, the mind-body connection had not been part of the training received by the medical staff caring for Grandpa at the time. To them, it was purely a physical condition, albeit a rare physical condition for a man of his age, and they treated it as such. Each day for the rest of his life, my grandpa took 14 different medications to offset the original condition and the unwanted side effects that appeared to be linked to his belief that he was helpless to help those that he loved. While I know that this would never be the official medical diagnosis, the correlations are just too high, and the studies too convincing to suggest that this condition simply happened. The power of our beliefs can work in either direction to become life-affirming or life-denying. Just as quickly as our unconscious beliefs can create conditions of suffering, they can reverse the conditions that threaten even life itself. What makes this possibility so appealing in our lives is that our beliefs can be changed intentionally in a moment in time. The key is to feel as if the beliefs are real rather than simply think, hope, or wish that they would become true in our lives. In this way, our personal beliefs can overcome the conscious beliefs held by those that we trust, such as doctors and friends. Sometimes all we need is for someone else to remind us that it's possible. Ultimately, the key to healing our most limiting beliefs may be found in healing our most intimate relationship in this world, the one that we identify between ourselves and the forces that make our world as it is, the forces of light and dark. It's our deepest, often unconscious beliefs about these forces that form the basis for all other beliefs as they play out in life-affirming or life-denying ways. The forces of light and darkness, eternal enemies or misunderstood realities. Without a doubt, we do live in a world of opposites. And without a doubt, it's the tension between those opposites that makes our world as it is. From the charges of atomic particles to the conception of new life, it's all about pluses and minuses, on and off, male and female. In theology, these opposites take on names and appearances that translate into the forces of light and dark, good and evil. While I'm not denying their existence, I am describing how it's possible to change what these forces mean in our lives and, by doing so, to redefine our relationship with their existence. If we see life as a constant battle between light and dark, then we must judge everything in life through the eyes of opposites, and the world looks like a really scary place. Such a view requires that we identify with one or the other, and that we see one as better or more powerful than the other. This is where we sometimes get into trouble with our own subconscious beliefs, as well as those of others. I remember thinking about this as a child, a lot. I struggled with the idea that we live in a world of good and evil, one force that likes me and one that does not, with both of them struggling to become the dominant force in my life. I simply couldn't accept that we may actually be living in this kind of world. Not so much because I didn't like the idea, but because it just didn't make sense. I knew that I would have to reconcile what I'd been taught about the forces of light and dark at some point in my life. Rather than a grand revelation in a single pivotal moment, however, that point came gradually as the result of a reoccurring dream that I had many times while I was in my 30s and 40s. Perhaps not coincidentally, that dream came during some of the greatest challenges and the deepest hurts of my life. I've always been a very visual person, so the visual nature of this particular dream, coupled with the powerful emotions of what it means to me, comes as no surprise. The dream always began in the same way. I saw myself alone in a place that was completely dark and completely empty. At first, there was nothing else around me, only the blackness that stretched everywhere and seemed endless. Gradually, however, something else always came into view, something a long way away, far off in the distance. As my eyes adjusted to what I was seeing and I was able to move closer, I began to recognize the faces of people. What I was seeing were people, a lot of people, some that I knew and some that I'd never seen before. As the dream came into focus, I realized that in that mass of people was everyone that I'd ever known or will ever know throughout my entire life, including all of my friends, all of my family, and every person that I've ever loved. And they are all there together, separated from me by a great divide that is opened in the blackness between us. This is where the dream got really interesting. Because on one side of the great divide was an abyss that was blindingly light, and on the other side of the divide was another abyss that was the darkest of the dark. Each time I tried crossing the divide to get to the people that I love, I found myself pulled off balance by one side or the other. Every time I resisted falling into either the darkness or the light, I found myself back at the place where I began, missing everyone tremendously as the people grew further and further away. One night I had the dream and something changed. It began the same, so by the time I realized what was happening, I knew what to expect. On this particular night, however, I did something different. As I started to cross the divide and felt the darkness and the light pulling me in opposite directions, I didn't resist, and I didn't surrender. Instead, I changed the way I felt in the presence of both, and I changed what I believed about them. Rather than judging one as good and one as bad, or either one as better or worse than the other, I allowed for both the light and the darkness to be present and let them become my friends. The instant that I did, something absolutely amazing happened. Suddenly, the light and the dark looked different to me. In that difference, they merged together, they filled the divide, and they became the bridge that led me to everyone that I loved. And once that happened, it was the end of the recurring dreams. While I've had other dreams that taught me in a similar way, I've never had that particular dream in that way again.